Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 9 of season 11 of Movie Rumbin at the Daily Podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Sam Edwards, an associate professor at Loughborough University. Welcome back to the show, Sam.
It's good to be back, Rob. Looking forward to talking with you.
Yes. It's going to be fun. It's another World War II movie. I know that's your expertise.
Yeah. So
why not?
That's my thing.
Exactly. So we ended things yesterday with Sobel leading the men, and the men are all hiding behind some trees, you know, on their way to some particular exercise, and you know the guys at the beginning of this segment start trying to convince Luz that maybe they should play a little trick on Sobel because Sobel can't see them. So one of the guys goes, maybe the good major could goose this schmuck, and then he goes, get us moving. No way. Oh yeah, yes, you got it. Come on. All right. And so Les goes, all right, just this once. And everyone's, shh, be quiet. And he clears his throat. And then we see a shot of Sobel looking at the map going 0.833356. He goes, isn't that the intersection? And the soldier next to him goes, no, sir, it's here. You're a full grid off. He goes, God damn it. And then we hear from behind the bushes. We know where it is. We hear, is there a problem, Captain Sobel? And Sobel quickly spins around and goes, who's that? Who broke silence? And the soldier next to him goes, I think it's Major Horton, sir. He goes, Major Horton? What? Did he join us? He goes, I think maybe he's moving between the platoons, sir. And then we get a shot of the men once again behind the trees, snickering and laughing, you know, about this, because they know what they're doing. And then Luz says, what is the goddamn hold up, Mr. Sobel? And again, the guys just burst out laughing. He goes, a fence, sir. A barbed wire fence. He goes, oh, that dog just ain't gonna hunt. I've never heard that phrase before. Have you ever heard that phrase before?
That's new on me, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very strange one.
It is.
We've talked about in Plane Change Automobiles, those dogs are barking. But, I've never heard this type of phrase before. You know, the dog just ain't gonna hunt. So I looked it up to see what I could find about it. And obviously, the first thing that comes up is this miniseries. So it's apparently an idiom, Southern American idiom, that means an idea, plan, or excuse or proposition is unworkable, ineffective, unbelievable, or inadequate for its position. It's a colloquial way to say something is a bad idea or won't succeed, stemming from the world of hunting where a dog that doesn't perform its job is useless.
Yeah.
And again, it works perfect here. Basically, he's saying, well, if you can't find a way around this, then you're of no use whatsoever. That's more or less what he's saying. Yeah. Now, again, this could be poetic license, but Luz himself is from Rhode Island, so you know that's not in the South. They don't use that phrase there, but maybe no. You know, I'm trying to remember if it ever mentioned. I mean, not in the miniseries, maybe in the book they mentioned about Horton, because you have it's Major Oliver Horton.
About where he's from.
In the book, anything about where he's actually from? It mentions the book does mention this story.
And so the implication is that he's a Southerner, right? Because that's what Les is doing.
That's the implication, but I don't know. According to the book, it doesn't mention where Horton himself actually comes from. And the funny thing is that there is no character who plays Horton in this in this entire series. He's mentioned numerous times, including the time when unfortunately they they mention that he got killed, but
yeah,
you know, because he gets killed in October 44.
Yeah.
And so he's from North Carolina.
Oh, there you go.
So yeah, but I don't know North Carolina. When I think of the South, I think of the Deep South. I don't think of
yeah. that. But yeah, I
hear. But North Carolina is still part of the South. So can't get away with that.
So I guess it tracks.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. I guess Luz was brushing up on his colloquialisms, trying to figure that out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, what's interesting is this entire scene is pretty much word for word from the book itself.
Yeah, and it's interesting where the series does that, where you have these little spots in the series of various places where they are clearly taken direct from Ambrose's book, and other places where they're kind of working around that material. Yeah, this is one of those spots where it's there in the book and it's there in the series.
Right. I mean, we talked about the whole thing with the spaghetti incident, where the spaghetti incident is one line in the book, but they, you know, expand it here into something much, much more visual that we can really understand what's going on.
Yeah. It's the skill of adapting a book into either film or TV. And there is a real skill in that of what do you take out of the book? What do you use? What do you expand on? What do you drop? And you get a sense of it here when you look at the Band of Brothers, the book, and then Band of Brothers series.
Yeah, for sure. And Luz continues with his imitations, and then he tells the guy, "Shut up," because guys are cracking up. I can imagine this type of situation. And then he says, "Now you cut that fence and get this goddamn platoon on the move." And he goes, "Yes, sir." And then Sobel turns to Evans, who's next to him, and he goes, "Where are my goddamn wire cutters, sir?" And then he gives it to him. So again, it's one of the things I love about this, and I mean, you just alluded to it a little bit before, that this is based on a real incident. If it wasn't based on a real incident, I don't know if I would really believe it. That they did something like that.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
We see that quite often throughout the entire series, where there are things that happen, and if it wouldn't have been written in the book, you'd say, "Oh my God, that where are they thinking up ideas like this?" And apparently it really happened.
Yeah. It's one of those moments you think, could this really happen? Because it does. Because as you say, it's in the book, and the veterans said, this actually happened, and it kind of gives this little window on something really interesting in the World War II military, and that's the role of humor, of pranking, of kind of working your way through, getting your way through the challenges and the boredom often of training by having some fun when and where you can.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I mean, I like the way that they do this, because they give us a realistic aspect of it.
Yeah, and they use it to draw out in a really interesting way what we're starting to get a sense of by that point in the episode and before, and that is their perception of Sobel, their kind of relationship with Sobel, their views in due course as well of Dick Winters. You kind of, this is that point in the series where they're developing these opposing ideas of what good leadership looks like, from the Sobel, the disciplinarian, versus Dick Winters and his kind of care for his men.
Right, exactly. And then the shot changes, and we actually see a watch that says it's slightly after 11 o'clock. And then we see that it's Winters' watch, and he says to Lipton, he goes, "We have to move." Lipton goes, "Sir, without Captain Sobel in first platoon?" And then he goes, "It's a T intersection. We improvise. Double envelopment laid on a base of fire to cut the road in all directions. Hook right with first quad. Tell Garnier to move left to second, and I'll be right up in the middle with the third. Go." He goes, "Yes, sir." Now, one of the things I love about this little scene here is the fact that, if they were in a real combat situation and they're waiting for another unit to show up, and that unit doesn't show up, then you obviously do need to improvise, because you can't just say, "Okay, let's just wait for them a little longer." It's possible that they were ambushed, that they got lost, like in this situation or whatever, and you have to you have your objective that you have to take care of. So
Yeah.
I like the fact that Winters, even though they're on combat exercises here, he's like, okay, this is if this was a real situation, we got to move on without them. He doesn't even need to explain why they need to go without them. He's like, okay, it's a T intersection. We're going to deal with what we need to. I mean, we'll see this in the second part of the miniseries also when we deal with Breton Court, the Breton Court Manor, the whole thing. It's the same type of thing. On the spot, Winters decides how he's going to deal with this situation based on his own personal, I guess, military knowledge in his mind of how things are supposed to be done.
Yeah, and the sequencing of the scene is the crucial bit as well, because as you say, immediately before we've got this scene of Sobel kind of disoriented and not quite knowing where he is and not quite knowing what to do, and he's indecisive and uncertain, and then that's followed by Winters, who improvises kind of decisively. He's clear with his orders. He tells his sergeant exactly what he wants to happen and how it's going to be done, and kind of responds positively and proactively in the moment. So again, we're offered this kind of this opposing vision of competent military leadership, Sobel's indecisiveness versus Winter's decisiveness.
Exactly, and again, they show it perfectly. I mean, I've asked this question before, and it's relevant now also. I don't understand how Sobel was able to actually finish officer's training without knowing how to read a map properly. You'd
It
think,
makes you wonder. It
yeah,
does.
exactly. You'd think that they would, have paid a little more attention to the fact that they're sending out an officer who is unclear as how to read a map. I mean, again, no one's perfect. I'm aware of that, and but it is possible that they're overextending his inevitability here than the way it was in real
Yeah.
life.
Yeah, I
Because
think there's, yeah.
it's partial comic, partial showing us, okay, this guy has no clue.
Yeah, ex and it's exactly that. There's, whilst this is a character based on a real human being, this is also a character in a TV series, and you do get a sense that he's being used in a certain way in order to tell a particular bit of the story, which is this is what bad leadership looks like, and this is what good leadership looks like.
Exactly, 100%. And then we get a shot of a British citizen
Yep.
riding down this little area on a bicycle. You'd think that if they were doing maneuvers like this, they would have warned the residents and said, "Okay, between 11 and 12, stay clear. We're having military exercises or something like that."
You would, but and I love this bit of the episode, this bit of the scene, because it kind of gives you so much interesting insight into what's happening in the months before D-Day in England, where you've got an enormous military presence, American, British, Canadian. And by the spring of 1944, there's about 1.5 million American service personnel in the British Isles, and there's a real big concentration in the southwest. And in places like so where the 101st are is in the county of Wiltshire, and by sort of April 44, there's almost 140,000 American soldiers just in that one county. And so what you get a sense of with this scene is there's training maneuvers happening all over, and yeah, communities will have been kind of told in advance that this is going to happen, but this maneuvering is happening in so many places. The British Isles are kind of crammed full of troops on training maneuvers. And you just get a lot wonderful little insight of it here with this yeah, as you say, this Briton on his bike who is taken prisoner by the Yanks, as he jokes at the end.
Yes, exactly. And then he goes, "Deary me!" And then, because he comes across a squad of men running across the road, and he turns around to go a different direction, and then another squad of men come by, and he goes, "Bloody hell!" And then a third group, the third squad moves past him, and he's had enough. He just stops dead in his tracks, and Winter sees him and stops. And just looks at him, and the guy just raises his arms and goes, "You've done it now, Yanks." You've captured me.
And I like the kind of wry smile on Winter's face, and they have this nice little exchange in and around that moment as well, as we then see what you're about to describe, which is Sobel turn up.
Exactly. And but the first thing that Winters does is he looks at his watch, which basically also tells us that he's very pleased with the amount of time it took them to take this intersection, what they need to do. Again, there's no resistance besides this Briton, so and there
And
wasn't
you're
much
right.
resistance from him.
And you're actually right about the importance of the watch. I think is we get that glimpse of it as it heads towards 11, and then at the end of the kind of the operation, like Winters is looking at checking the timing and things. And again, it just gives you another little insight into something so crucial throughout the conflict, but especially in the kind of the weeks and months before D-Day. Time really was important. Like D-Day itself, that operation is planned down to the minute. You just get a little bit of a sense of the significance of doing things by a schedule on time, making sure you're meeting the kind of the time in which something's supposed to happen. In that one scene there, it's a great little scene.
And then we hear we hear Sobel's chant of Hyo Silver, and then you see them running towards them. Now, again, I have no idea what is actually supposed to be happening in this particular in this particular military exercise that they're doing, because just beforehand Sobel was talking about the fact that they need to have noise discipline. But then here he's running down the road screaming Hyo Silver. So again, I don't know what they're may it is possible that the idea is that they were supposed to defend this T intersection against Sobel and his squad. It's very possible. Because that's why the next line from this elderly Briton is, would that be the enemy? And it's hard to tell what Winters' answer really means, because he goes, as a matter of fact, yes. So is he saying that in this particular exercise they're supposed to be playing the enemy, or it's Sobel and Sobel is the enemy?
I think it's the second. Yeah, I
I
think
think so too. I think so too, but it doesn't make any sense that they're running towards this objective.
unless it's because he's got himself so behind time, and he was so off grid with where he should have been, Sobel and his team, that they're charging to where they should have been to get there as quickly as possible. And again, it's an opportunity, I guess, for the series to kind of paint Sobel in a slightly ridiculous light, that he's charging down the road shouting "Hi ho, Silver!" Kind of is a there's a bit of a, you get a sense there that this is sending the character up to a degree as well.
Yeah, that's true. But again, I'm thinking about it from a military discipline perspective. You're not going to have a squad of men running down the road so clumped up together.
No, which
Even
again suggests that he doesn't know what he's doing.
that's
Yeah.
right. No, but the men
Yeah.
do. That's something we'll talk about over the course of the next of tomorrow and Monday. But the men know how dangerous Sobel is to them, and even though you're supposed to follow an order, you're not necessarily going to want to follow an order that's going to theoretically, kill you, kill your character, kill what's going on. So, it's an
Yeah.
interesting perspective on the whole thing. So, but I do like the dichotomy of Winter's line about it, as a matter of fact, yes, because it could theoretically mean either. I tend to agree with you that they are, he's probably mostly referring to the fact that Sobel himself is the enemy, but it still works.
Yeah, you get the sense. Yeah, absolutely agree. It does work. And you get a sense that Winters is using the opportunity provided by the question from the Brit to kind of to make a point. Yeah, as a matter of fact, this individual is the enemy.
Exactly. And then Winters leaves this old man, this elderly man, and he walks over to his men, and he goes, "Good work, Second Platoon. We took the objective." And that also is another, just that line, just having Winters walk over and compliment the men is just great. Because again, what that's telling us is that here is a commander who is appreciative of the hard work that the men are putting in, and you know, of what they're doing and how they're doing it and stuff like that.
Yeah, and as you say, like, there are a few, like, I absolutely agree. I like it too. And there are a few places where these kind of signs of Winter's skill and his competence and his care and thought for his men really comes through. And as you say, that's one of those, and it's handled nicely.
Yeah, exactly. And then the shot changes, and we see a bunch of cows.
Because the fence has been cut. Yeah.
And then Strayer goes, "Who was the idiot who cut that man's fence?"
Yeah, and this happened, right? You know, these, as I say, there were so many maneuverings happening in the months and weeks before D-Day, some little exercises and training, and it was happening on farmland, on agricultural land, so damage to fences, damage to walls, you know, cattle being accidentally let out. This stuff happened. There was the US military used to offer compensation for damage done to farmland or to fences and things like that if it was suffered by the farmers. So yeah, you get, again, a nice little scene, gives you a little window onto the weeks and the months before D-Day as the training ramps up in southern England as the 101st ready themselves for D-Day.
Right, and in some ways it's disrupting the life of the people living there.
Absolutely.
By everything that they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's useful to think of southern England by spring of 1944 as like a huge armed camp. And that's how many troops are there and how many are in training. Yeah.
Yeah. So then Sobel says, "I was ordered to, sir." "By whom?" "Major Horton, sir." "Major Horton." "Yes, sir." "Major Horton told you to do that." "Yes, sir." "Major Horton ordered you to cut the fence." I love how he repeats himself three times just to be clear that he's hearing this properly. And he goes, "Yes, he did." He goes, "Major Horton's on leave in London." and then he just walks away and yells at one of his men and goes, "Get those cows out of here." But the punchline here is seeing Sobel's face. On the one hand, we're supposed to not like him, but you do feel a little bad for him in this particular situation because they, you know, a prank was played on him that has caused him quite a lot of anguish at this point. I mean, at least he wasn't punished for this whole thing, but you know, but he also knows here that someone just played a trick on him, and he wants to find a way to enact some sort of revenge on this.
Yeah, and one of those moments where, in a very subtle way, David Schwimmer reminds us what a great actor he is. He's very good at those kind of telling looks which convey lots and seem like they're really straightforward and easy, but are clearly the work of a very capable actor.
Yeah, for sure. Again, I've mentioned this numerous times, and I'm sure I'll mention it many times in the future. David Schwimmer is, in my opinion, the perfect person to cast in this role because it's so much against what we would have expected. You know, and it shows how powerful and how competent an actor he can be, that he's, you know, here he played Ross Geller for 10 seasons and, you know, that's his personality. And here they're putting him in the quote unquote bad guy spotlight here, or someone who's not nice, I guess you'd say. And he excels in it because it's so believable.
Yeah. And that's a skillful casting move because there's potentially a risk to it, you know, because he is so well known as Ross Geller and that character and so likable as that character, that's a risky move because there's, you know, the danger is that you put him into this role and he gets lambasted by the critics for failing to deliver, but he does deliver because that's how good an actor he is, that he can be Ross Geller as we know him and yet dropped into this role and be a very different character and carry it off and do it well.
Right. For sure. The shot changes and we see a Jeep driving through this little town, and you know, it passes a number of the men. We can recognize some of them. We see that Lipton is coming out of this little I guess laundry station.
Yeah.
And they're in Oldbourne Village.
That's the one, Oldbourne Village, Wiltshire. Yeah. And there's a few of them playing basketball as the Jeep.
Right. that, I mean, the sign says laundry daily service 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. closed Sundays. Mrs. E.M. Lamb to the close. And then it says Aldburn Village.
There you go. Yep. So. And that was absolutely a thing that would happen in some of these villages that the around American camps that local people, often local women, would take on laundry for some of the US troops, and some of the troops billeted on the local communities as well, which comes out in the scene later as well. We learn that that Dick Winters is billeted there in the village.
Exactly, and we get another shot of the Jeep driving down the street, and it interrupts the men playing basketball. You know, they, but again, this is Evans. Evans is Sobel's lackey. So, you know, he's going to act the same way that, that Sobel would have acted. And Evans gets out of the Jeep. Did you recognize who the actor is who plays Evans?
It's a young Simon Pegg.
Yes, it is. That it is. So he gets out of the Jeep and walks towards, Winters and says, "Lieutenant Winters," and he salutes him. And then he hands him a piece of paper and says, "With Captain Sobel's compliments, sir." And then he turns to Nixon and salutes to Nixon and goes, "Lieutenant." And then he just turns around and goes back to the Jeep to go on. And then Nixon and Winters start looking at this paper. So then Winters says, "Oh, for crying out loud." And then Nixon looks over and laughs and goes, "He misspelled court-martial." Which, you know, it's a nice little jab that, you know, as efficient as you can be, you still need to be able to spell. The way this scene is played out in the miniseries is different than it did in the book, the way that it was explained. In the book, it is all shown that, you know, we see what was typewritten as opposed to what actually happened.
Okay.
You know, they didn't meet between they didn't meet up about the whole thing. Basically, it says actually, you know what? I'll read. We'll go through the scene, and then I'll read after what actually is written in the book about this whole thing. So the scene good, yeah. Changes, and now we see Winters following Sobel inside some sort of headquarters, and they're walking upstairs, and he goes, "No, sir, I do not understand. Your orders to me were to inspect the latrines at 1000 hours. From 0930 to 0955, I was censoring the enlisted men's mail by order of Colonel Strayer. At 1000 hours, I followed your orders to the minute." And Sobel just looks at him and goes, "I changed the time to 945. And he goes, "No one told me, sir." He says, "I telephoned." He goes, "I'm quartered with a family that has no telephone." So, again, it's very funny, the whole idea that who did he telephone then?
Yeah.
he says, "I telephoned." Okay, you telephoned, but to who?
Yeah, you get a real who sense this is a deliberate attempt to catch Winters out, right?
Yeah, for sure. There's no question about that. That's exactly what it is that he's trying to do. So again, I'll start reading a little bit of what is talks here, because right now we just finished this 5 minute segment. So tomorrow we'll continue with this conversation between Winters and Sobel, but at least we can discuss right now what specifically is going on between, you know, in the book about the whole thing. So it says, "At 1045 hours, Winters walked into the orderly room to get ready for the company formation. With a hint of a smirk on his face, First Sergeant Evans handed him a typed document. It read, 'Company E 506 PIR, 30 October 43. Subject, punishment under 104th Article of War. To First Lieutenant R.D. Winters. You will indicate by endorsement," and it says endorsement with an I as opposed to an E, "you indicate by endorsement below whether you deserve punishment under 104th AW or trial by courts martial for failure to inspect the latrine at 0945 this date as instructed by me. Signed with a grand flourish, Herbert M. Sobel, Captain Commanding." Winters confronted Sobel. "Captain," he said, after saluting and asking permission to speak, "my orders were to inspect the latrine at 1000 hours. I changed that time to 945. No one told me. I telephoned, and I sent a runner." Winters bit his tongue. There was no telephone in his room, and no runner had come. Basically, I'll continue this tomorrow when we continue the story.
That sounds good.
You know, in the miniseries itself. But again, it's great the way that they do this, because they really give us an indication as to the fact that he really was just doing this despite.
Yeah, and you get a real sense that it's building towards something, right? Towards a kind of a confrontation, towards a resolution of sorts, which is what we then do start to see in the scenes that follow.
Yeah, exactly. So is there anything else you wanted to mention about this particular 5-minute segment?
The only other thing is, and we've already kind of touched on it, is it's a really interesting scene from my perspective as someone who works on the history of World War II, but also the history of the American military in England during World War II. And as I say, there's some wonderful moments in this scene where you get a sense of their kind of relationship with some of the locals, the bicycle riding Brit that they encounter, their presence in the local community, that they use the services of local people for their laundry, that they're playing American sports in an English village, that these are villages which are kind of resounding to the life and laughter of thousands of young Americans. So I think I love this scene because it captures a little bit of that kind of really important moment in the British experience of the Second World War, which is the arrival of hundreds of thousands of Americans as allies to fight and win the war.
Right. And one of the things that's great also is that we see in a tracking shot when the Jeep is going down the road that there are even some local females that are talking or flirting with some of the soldiers that are there too.
Which is absolutely, a huge part of that. So it's referred to in the history and also kind of in memory as well, in popular memory, how people think about this event. It's referred to as the Friendly Invasion, this invasion of 1.5 million American service personnel, which would have profound kind of consequences for the social landscape of the UK. And one bit of it would absolutely be romantic relationships between American GIs and British women. In the war's aftermath, there would be tens of thousands of British women that would go home with American soldiers as what were called at the time war brides. And you just get a little bit of a hint of that in this scene.
Right. Sure. All right. Excellent. So we will now play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie.
Cool. Let's do it.
Where I will randomly give you some hints, and you have to try and guess what movie it is that we're referring to.
Okay.
Spin the wheel, and we will see what movie pops up for you. And around and around and around the wheel goes. Okay, this is a movie that is actually based on a TV show. It was originally a TV show that came out in America in the 1960s, 1962. And they made two movies about these same characters in 1965. It's about a group of enlisted men and officers on a PT boat. In the Pacific. Any idea what we're referring to? They did make a remake in 1997, I believe.
1997. Yeah, I can picture what we're talking about here, but I can't for the life of me remember the name of it. Put me out of my misery, Rob. What is it?
It stars Ernest Borgnine and Tim Conway.
Yeah.
Does that help at all?
Yeah, it does. I can picture it. I can vision. I can't think of the name.
Mikhail's Navy.
Mikhail's Navy. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. You'll have another opportunity tomorrow.
Look forward to it.
All right. So, Sam, would you like to tell people where they can find you?
So you can find me on my website, which is www.runninghistorian.co.uk. You can also find me on Blue Sky as Running Historian. And if you chuck my name into Google, Sam Edwards at Loughborough University, UK, you can find me that way as well.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a search for Movie Run Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierunminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierunminute@movierun.net. So, until tomorrow, Curry!
Curry!